People need to know there is an ad-free version of the show they can listen to.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have any kind of ads on it.
Right.
And because we need to create an ad-free version, I would like to create this version with an ad, even though we're not getting paid for any ads. Please give me an ad.
Okay.
I need you to generate one out of thin air right now.
I would like to talk about Cooper tires. Does your vehicle skid?
Hold on, is that even a real thing?
It doesn't matter.
Nobody talks about Cooper tires.
You're right, Michelin.
Build your next move, make your next square with Squarespace.
Okay.
You can create a custom... I don't even listen to these commercials long enough to know what they are anymore. Let's make an actual commercial for something called additional content.
Oh.
Because this is fucking awesome.
I love additional content. I'm here. Hello. Hello. My name's Michael Kester. You may know me from such programs as Double Feature and Double Feature Additional Content.
What?
What's that?
What's that second one? I haven't heard of it.
You're not familiar with Double Feature? Well, let me tell you, friends. Friends and friends of friends and friends of Eric's who are also able to see my posts on Facebook.
Who are you talking to?
Just you. It's basically its own podcast. It follows its own set of rules. It's called Double Feature Additional Content. If you've not heard this podcast, you've basically missed... Well, you've missed a ton. You've missed 2 years of basically an entire other show.
I think we're at 40 episodes
it's,
now, aren't
it's
we?
Outrageous how much content...
39,
how
maybe?
How much additional content has been generated. So these are shows entirely created by people who have donated to the show previously, and they're just full of movies that you and I are... at that point, indentured to view and discuss. We have no say in any relief. We don't get to pick other movies that go with them. Those are largely just movies that people sit in front of us, and we have to sit there with a knife and a fork and digest them when we can't get up. I mean, we're talking like the first scene of Seven. We can't get up until they are fully consumed.
Is that the first scene of Seven?
I don't know. No, it's definitely not. I think the first scene of Seven involves...
right to the title sequence? This doesn't matter. You know, you can find out if you go back to, what, year two when we did
you could
Seven?
Also you could available also donate the, to the show at the level that allows you to choose additional content and make us rewatch Seven.
That's good. That's nobody's tried that
yet.
That's
a power that you have. If you think that, say, we did a bad job with, I don't know, sneakers, you can make us watch it again through the power of additional content.
I'll fight him on that. So, listen, this is on patreon.com/doublefeature. And I get to talk to you about an additional content thing. Maybe we'll save it for the end of the show.
Are you talking about the one that the reason that looming dark cloud of impending additional content that seems like it should have been here already?
Yeah, that additional content thing that has to be done, and I'm both excited and horrified.
That's an accurate way to feel.
I think we'll talk about it a little at the end. Let's see what happens at the end of the episode. Uh-huh. But for now, go to patreon.com/doublefeature. You can sign up. You can grab all the old episodes of the show, the additional content, and more.
Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric 13. I am here with Department of Transportation and Vietnam, Michael Kester.
There you go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would have also accepted professional Russian roulette loser, Michael Kester.
Oh, that's good too. Yeah, that's great. But there's a trick to Russian roulette.
Yeah.
And that is
it, don't play.
Damn. You get me every time. It's like I'm not nearly as clever as I think I am. No, actually, I should save the trick for when we talk about the film involving Russian roulette.
Okay.
I'd like you to roll the die and tell me which film you think that is.
I know
you
now.
You have a 50-50 chance of getting it correct.
That's assuming that I'm only going to pick the two movies we're covering today, which are The Deer Hunter and Trainspotting.
What you should do is have a 100% chance by picking the one you've watched that had Russian roulette in it. That would be the best way to play this game.
So that will be The Deer Hunter for those of you playing at home. And that will be the first film on today's double feature.
Ooh. So when I played Russian roulette with two movies and tried to figure out the order, and I went, I have a clue. One has "the" in it, mm-hmm. and I put it second. That was not the right choice.
That was an incorrect call. Train Spotting goes second, and that begins at the 24-minute mark. But something tells me you've probably already seen it. Everyone here has seen Train Spotting now, as of now.
Yes, right this second.
Not the case last week, but definitely both hosts, 100% of your faithful double feature hosts have viewed Train Spotting.
I notice you're leaning on Train Spotting. You did watch The Deer Hunter, right?
I watched.
That wasn't as big of a, watched The Deer Hunter.
The Deer Hunter.
That seems like more of the challenge given the length of the film.
Felt way more like a challenge.
It's also not an easy 3 hours.
Exactly. Train Spotting, surprisingly an easy 90 minutes.
Yes.
For such a fucking hard movie.
Right.
One of the things that we'll definitely get to with Train Spotting. But what I want to talk about before we get to anything and before you get to your thing is, I already know who we're talking about, so I guess that'll be me too. But I want to talk about the journey, because the journey is ending, Eric.
Should we talk about it now or after it's actually ended? I mean, that seems like that would be a good
place. I mean, I want to preface this pair, though.
Okay, you want to swing up to the... Yeah, I got you.
So the idea at this point with pairing The Deer Hunter and Train Spotting is that if you are following along at home, we've kind of followed an arc of... being a person whose life has been changed or altered by war, and a person whose life has been changed or altered by drugs. And we're kind of following this downward trajectory. We've gone from, this is fun, all the way down past the intervention last time. And now we are firmly at, you done fucked up. This is the point, you are beyond the point of no return. This is all bad, no good. This is you and all your friends' lives have been invariably ruined, and you have no hope for anything at all whatsoever. But before we get to that joyous conversation that I'm sure we're about to have.
So good at getting people into this.
Get pumped. Do you want to ask me how I know Andrew Trent?
I do, mostly because I'm just going to do this boldly and with confidence as if I know how to do it. This will be really funny if I ombre this up right here.
It's Spanish for butterfly.
Space vampire.
Yes.
Beyond Mariposa.
There you go. You nailed it. Good job.
Yeah. Mariposa is a place in California, isn't it? I should really know what...
It might be, but it's Spanish for butterfly.
Oh, okay. Well, usually what I would do on the show is just go beyond butterfly.
Right.
That wouldn't have been right. How do you know Andrew Trent?
Andrew Trent, actually, I've played shows with Space Vampire down here in beautiful Austin, Texas.
Really?
Yeah, Andrew Trent and the rest of his band, Space Vampire. Actually, when I was still a resident of Guntown, back up north in Illinois.
Chicago, you mean Chicago.
Right, yeah, the town where Guns are
banned. It's funny that you are in Texas. I thought Guntown was an actual town you used to live in Texas, but no, you mean the South Side.
Yeah.
Or Chicago, I suppose.
Right. When we toured down here, we played with Space Vampire. So they were kind of the first people in Austin I ever really met.
Ah.
And so when we moved down here before Rob Lewin Davis'd me, we played a bunch of shows with Andrew Trent and Space Vampire, and their album Beyond Mariposa is available on Apple Music, if you can believe it.
It is. It's on legit. A bunch of stuff. It's on Spotify, yep. And Amazon, and and on Bandcamp.
Right.
Actually, the weirdest place it is Nosferatu.
Nosferatu. Get it?
I mean, I assume it's their website. Uh-huh. But I would love it if it's just coincidentally a place that you buy music.
But they're a space-themed rock band. All their songs are about space. All of them. Every song is about space.
This isn't just a hip name. I wanted to ask you that because I haven't heard this band yet. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you that, but I knew I would get the unfortunate answer of no, it's just their name. They don't write every song about space or anything.
Right.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. The more important question for me, because I think about nothing if not myself, is Andrew Trent, I guess, listens to our show or at least found our Kickstarter page.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever told him about the show?
Probably. I tell everybody. I mean, okay. When I speak to people and they go, "Where have you been for 3 days?" I go, "I do this podcast." It's called double feature.
Right, right.
And then they invariably go, did you do the new Ghostbusters?
And you go, give me $35.
Right.
You have $35 I could have. Give me $35. It's so funny. All right, well, Andrew, if you are listening, or if, and I like this just as much, if you've never listened but thought this was a great opportunity to get your stuff on the show, thanks.
Thank you
and,
so much.
You can stream that stuff for free on Apple Music.
And you should. It
doesn't
really
cost money.
It's
just go in there.
Especially if you like space.
If you dig the band, buy the album. Normally, I would just be like, free music, the future, streaming, blah, blah, blah. But you make pennies on streaming.
We did Llewyn Davis last week. Please buy the album.
Right, right. If anyone bought the album this year and Double Feature wasn't already so in debt, I might have to file taxes. So that would be great. It would be great if I had to file taxes, you guys. That's never thought I would say that. All right, so we are starting with The Deer Hunter, which feels so weird because of the doo-wop rule.
I know.
You do the second. So I should tell you this in advance. I was regretful after American Sniper and The Man with the Golden Arm. I was having a conversation with somebody about this. And I went, damn, that was our last of those war peace shows. We really didn't do a very good job on just like figuring out where we went. And then I actually thought in my head, this seems like one of those things I would totally fuck up, but Michael would catch. I don't know why he didn't. I was actually mad at you. I was like, why didn't Michael fucking catch this? And then I looked at the schedule and I had double fucked up because actually this is the last one.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really sure where this would slide on down to, but, Vietnam, of course.
Sure.
Good evening.
Sure,
fucking
sure.
Vietnam. Yes, because double feature. And if it's double feature, it must be Vietnam. I don't know. Thanks, Saw, for not making any more movies.
Yeah.
Now, if it's double feature, it must be Vietnam. It's the movie that, I mean, I'm not going to hide this at all. I think it's the movie we've been begging for.
Yeah.
As we cover these war movies.
I mean, it's so emblematic of the point that I was hoping we could make with this part of the programming this year, because it is it's a full story. It's not dropped in the middle of the jungle of Vietnam. It's not starting at the war and coming back home. I mean, you start never having been to combat. You start as three friends who are in the prime of their life in a small town. And these are the people that we've talked about before. These are the people that end up going to war because that's just what you do.
Yeah.
Especially at that time in history.
I know they're in the middle of everything and nobody wants them to go. And they're like, well, it's, you know, we got to go. It'll just be a second. We just got to go. And we've seen that with the other Vietnam movies, or even with American Sniper. Like, just hang out here. It'll just be a couple of weeks. I'll be right back. I have to serve my country. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I just have to.
And then, I mean, what I expected from a 3-hour epic like this, first off, what I didn't expect is to spend the first hour not at war, which I think is one of the strongest things the movie does in proving the point that the movie does. But the other thing that surprised me is how little time we spend actually in combat.
Especially before we're captured.
Yeah. I mean,
it's as if we're dropped in Vietnam into an enemy's camp.
Yeah, it is.
But they go, you're ours now.
The combat portion of this film, the actual, I would say, well, no, I wouldn't. But the firefight war portion of the film is minimal. You'd blink and you'd miss it.
Yeah.
And immediately you are at the horrors of war. The real, you know, what a lot of people would argue is the real part of war, which is individuals being terrible to each other on an almost personal level.
Yeah.
And
It is. Can we pause on that? Actually, that's a really good point that we shouldn't go through this whole thing without talking about. We can expand on it later if you want.
Yeah, sure.
But when we are in the moments of doing things like Russian roulette, it is, I guess we did see it again in American Sniper. It just didn't feel as bad because it wasn't being done to us because we're white. They were brown in that movie. But, you know, the amount of in your face, I hate you, the guy who gets up in the morning and goes to the store and reads the paper and then, like, you know, goes to his kid's soccer game. You, I have a personal problem with you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when they are attacking and, you know, I guess we still, now we see people from Vietnam doing it to white Americans. So now we feel that it's bad and we didn't last time. I speak about that sarcastically as how I think other people view the movie. Much like you do last time, I think I have to stop and go, that's terrible, is my point. my super dry point that should not be mistaken. But they're making people play Russian roulette. You're going, why are you fucking with these guys so much?
Right.
Russian roulette is, you know, of the terrible ways for people to kill each other. This is psychologically one of the fucking worst. It's just, well, you're going to die by your own hand, maybe, at a point you don't know. It will probably happen. Maybe you'll see someone else get shot a foot in front of you by their own hand, knowing your own fate. It just seems so intimate. Mm-hmm. And why? It's awful. It's fucking awful.
Well, and the fact that to get out of that situation, it requires the same level of personal violence, man-to-man violence. I mean, you're essentially going, okay, well, do I shoot myself in the head? Does my friend shoot himself in the head? Or should we just kill all these guys?
I'm almost...
Or die, and maybe die in the process, right? Maybe fail at that and just have killed some people before we died.
Well, one of the other things that this whole journey, and especially this movie, is hammered in, and it's still honestly maybe the way I feel, but I always look at war as something stupid someone else is doing. Mm-hmm. It is a dumb decision by two countries' political figures. I don't think of war personally.
Right.
And what this is, the lesson I learned here today, what have we learned here today? Is that people go to war and they look at the other soldiers as other men that they will take on because you are right and they are wrong. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but feel like, you know, whose war am I fighting? Not my war. My government decided to go to war and I got stuck here. And, you know, even if I'm feeling super patriotic about it, my government decided to go to war. I've decided to help my government and so I go to war. But I'm really hoping that they can win. Right. I don't have that that football thing where I go, we
sure,
won.
Sure.
I go, oh, that team on the field that is from my city, that is the one that won. I don't know why I don't have that personal, maybe it is a sports thing, but I don't have that. Do you get that, a personal association of, did we go get Osama bin Laden or did we find out that someone got Osama bin Laden?
I guess not.
Try and take the fact that
I just
we found just
it
like
out. I just found it out.
Chucked him in the ocean.
Yeah, I just found out he died.
Okay. Not right now, you mean. You mean at the moment you just felt like. No, you just found out that Osama bin Laden.
I just found out you're surprising me right now. No, I'm just saying.
Sorry, I'm having a moment here.
No, I just found out I did not feel like I had any personal. I mean, I didn't have any personal say in any of that scenario.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it just seems like the lives of others, and so to see people take it personally and really get in it is. I don't know, the most personal thing I've had about this is actually going through all these war films. That has felt to me like, to use someone else's miserable words, my own personal Vietnam, right? Is having to watch all these war films and starting at, okay, I learned my lesson, war's terrible, and then just getting deeper and deeper in that. It's weird to think that this is the movie that we've waited for because, you know, this movie completely and utterly just destroys everything. It is just grisly and human and grisly. And every time we came on the show and went, but the implications, I felt like we were always kind of showing up and being like, this is how this movie represented war. It didn't talk enough about mutilating corpses.
Right.
And every conversation had a little bit of, and let's balance it out by talking about corpses.
Right. Well, and I mean, also to a point, every time we would come and go, war takes a really serious toll on people psychologically, but we never really got, even with American Sniper, we never got to a brass tacks scenario where a guy had completely lost his mind and was just professionally playing Russian roulette in Saigon.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
because war was
especially
bad.
Maybe with American Sniper. They go, this is a huge part of the story. Would be cool if we could see inside his head, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, see ya. And, you know, there's definitely the Kubrick stuff definitely gets you in there, but I don't think anything puts you inside the head quite as much as this, just because of how, you know, it's the fucking Requiem for a Dream of
absolutely
war movies. I mean, I know it's a stupid thing to say when we have
no. Well, it's not
Trainspotting, the movie that literally has a freak out scene with a game show.
Like, it's not
this is the wrong one to compare.
So that's actually not the wrong thing to say for two reasons, and one is the big reason, but the other is that Requiem for a Dream was, and you're gonna love this, was the first thing I thought of when I was like, oh, we should do like a bottom last hitting rock bottom drug movie. Sure, and then I thought to myself, I feel like we probably would have done Requiem already. And I had to go on our website and verify that we had indeed covered Requiem.
Did you use the handy search feature?
I did. Doublefeature.fm, handy search feature on the.
It's a great.
I probably use that way more than the average person.
all the hits to that website are ours.
But the other conversation that I. And this was the overarching heavy-handed, I'm sorry if your eyes roll, point that I wanted to make with all of this. And I think we see it in Chris Walken's character at the end of this movie, but also with everybody's ultimate fallout from their time in Vietnam, which is that war is kind of a drug.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that you do voluntarily once, and then it becomes something that you identify yourself by, then it becomes something that you do without realizing you're doing it. Then it becomes something that maybe you realize you're too deep into and you try to get out. And then finally it becomes something that consumes you. And that's been the secret arc of the movies we've covered, secret or not so secret, but this movie nails that.
There's a term for it. I don't know if it's a subgroup of this or if they're just if it's kind of like a sister problem, but adrenaline junkie.
Sure, sure.
You live in war and that was a big Chris Kyle thing, but you have this job that you're into, but also just the fact that you might live or die, while that feels terrible to me sitting at a mixing board right now, it must, after you live that way every day, you have a certain amount of I feel alive, and then you come back and you have to play Russian roulette, otherwise just what,
and
you're sleeping all day.
This movie also plays with not only that, but also the guilt, survivor's guilt, right? You have the fact that Nick is wiring money back to his friend who was horribly maimed in front of him, and he's basically just like, it's this amazing thing when people talk about experimenting with drugs. And you and I mean, I don't know, we don't have a whole lot of insight into that specifically, but there are certain drugs that even I, as a human being who does not partake of much substance, there's drugs like cocaine, drugs like marijuana that, you know, you can be a casual user. You can be a weekend warrior. Or, right. I mean, marijuana specifically, that's almost commonplace. It is commonplace in current times. And then you have drugs like ecstasy, LSD, mushrooms, that to a certain degree, there's a certain connotation that goes, I mean, that you get in your head there and you may never come back out.
Yeah.
And then there's the really dangerous stuff, specifically in this heroin,
Vietnam, they're really hard drugs.
Well, the ones where once you do it once and that could be it, you're hooked, you're wrecked.
Sure. Opium's a huge fucking problem with veterans. It's it's so not talked about nearly enough, but I mean, it's a huge problem in our country today. Just, you know, people get prescribed pain medicine, and you know, I don't know what we do to solve that or whatever. I wanted to say, and there's no help for them to make sure they get off it, but I don't fucking know what we do about it, except at least talk about it more. But most of the country has, as we were talking about with antidepressants on the show, a high number of people have a sort of faux hyperbolic PTSD and are, you know, they are on drugs to numb the awful. And opium is one that, you know, you need it for medical reasons and then you get hooked, and it happens to a lot of soldiers.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I love specifically about the way the Deer Hunter tackles all of this stuff is that, and we're going to see it again in the next movie, and like we covered at the beginning of this conversation, it opens with just three guys, you know? Mm-hmm. The movie opens and you identify so strong. It's just you and your two best friends, right?
Yeah, for a couple of weeks of vacation, no big deal.
I mean, it's to go from the beginning of this movie to where this movie ends. That's one thing. I mean, you have a person who's been horribly maimed by battle, a person who has committed suicide after a long-standing fugue state in Saigon. Mm-hmm. And then you have the one guy who was kind of the leader of the whole crew who, what's he got left? You know, Meryl Streep, I guess.
Yeah.
But the other thing too, and this is how I know that the movie knows not only what it's saying, but it feels almost like this last moment in the movie was like, there's going to be a podcast called Double Feature and they're going to need a war movie that really makes a point here. So we were just going to end, but could y'all just sing God Bless America? Right. Because that's that beat at the very end of the movie is essentially going, so this is America for you. And that's ultimately the point that that's where this has to end. I wish that there were a sixth journey flick where, and then we got out of war and there was no war anymore.
There was never a war again.
Exactly.
And then we didn't stop calling it war and called it something else and just do it every day. Well, this should have been, I make these jokes about all these Vietnam movies, like, oh fuck, we got to do another Vietnam movie. But I have to be honest, this was so, I should have been beaten down by this. And this was so satisfying. It was this kind of purge.
Right. It finally felt like something got it, right?
Yeah.
It just felt absolutely. Like, it, for me, I'm watching The Deer Hunter going, okay, I'm not alone in feeling this way.
Great, you guys all have different perspectives, and I've learned a lot about how you see things, but you're all fucking wrong. It's just terrible. Oh, good, The Deer Hunter gets it. That's my, you know, that's my non-objective viewpoint that, I mean, this is an easy argument. You just morally agree with it or you don't. There isn't a lot of area to really, you could start getting into like, well, how much does it actually help and how does it fuck with people and whatever. But I feel like, you know, agree to disagree. That's mm-hmm. just, we come in and I go, yeah, The Deer Hunter. That's, look, it continues ruining people's lives even after the thing is done. You know, he might be playing Russian roulette because of the adrenaline thing. But he might also be going, it might be a substitute for suicide. It mm-hmm. might be just, I don't know, put it in somebody else's hands. I don't fucking know what to do. And just fall back into it. It's his way of disconnecting. Mm-hmm. But that, all these tense scenes with the Russian roulette, they feel like, well, a bomb could go off in a war at any time and you could die. It is luck of the draw. It just happens or it doesn't. And we can't make that any more perfectly minimalistic than Russian roulette. And I also love the notion that he's sending money back because he's really good at Russian roulette. He's one of the top players at Russian roulette. Right. Like, I have some news for you, my friend. There are not top players at Russian roulette. That's
You're sitting there going, well, I'd like to see the training montage in which he became the best Russian roulette player.
You know, a lot of people don't make it out of that montage. So I love the implication that he's probably sending money home because he's great at Russian roulette, which is just so funny. But I did say that I would give you the heads up at how to win on Russian roulette. And it's easy. You just don't wear the squib headband.
Oh, there you go.
That's how you, yes. Go back through this movie and watch all the people whose brains get blown out are wearing the headbands. It's beautiful. So don't wear the squib headband. And now do some drugs.
Yeah. So Trainspotting. I mean, at the commencement of this movie, it's important to look at I want to look at the ending first. I think it's the important thing to our points about this movie. And I'm basically going to call anybody out. And I don't know if you're included in this. We have not spoken.
Yeah, you're also going to speak for me. So that's good. But I always get excited when you feel free to
try and refute me.
All right.
To anybody that believes that this film ends with Ewan McGregor kicking drugs and finding a lot of money and going to start a fresh new life, you are sadly mistaken. This movie ends with a heroin addict getting so much money that he can OD probably as soon as the camera stops rolling.
Probably in the next scene. Yeah. Well, and also fucking over everyone he knows.
Right.
And
no,
completely
I mean,
ruining all as the
people,
much as he can.
All the people whom have managed to survive around him to this point, lives are ruined while he goes and blows all of their money on committing suicide.
See, I can stay on the, we were talking about Inside Llewyn Davis last time on the show, and whether or not we agreed that that character is fucking everything up.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie where I can get on board with that.
Yeah.
These are literally all the worst decisions.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I almost want to say this is a counterpoint to Llewyn Davis.
Sure.
It is a movie where an individual does look at every single thing and intentionally does the fucking wrong ones
right.
over and over and over. The viewpoint that I look at this whole movie through and why I feel like the ending is kind of a no-brainer to feed into that theme is I feel like the movie puts on a show that it is trying to cut around and treat upbeat and make heroin as cool as fucking possible.
Yeah.
But heroin's just so bad that you can't do that.
Exactly.
Just no, that, hey, this guy's in a really disgusting bathroom. Whoa, so cool. Look at all these scenes. And you're going... Yeah. No, that's a fucking disgusting.
Right.
Get out of there. That's terrible. Look, he goes swims through the water and isn't this cool? No. Leave. It's bad.
In a lot of ways, it's Fear and Loathing if you weren't also on drugs. You're just watching.
You're the sober person at the party of Train Spotting and you're going, guys, I know you all think this is really cool, but you're swimming in a toilet. And I think the movie knows it's doing that. I think that's intentionally what it's doing.
Well, one of the things I wish I could say, and I'm glad I can't, is I want to say that this is a Danny Boyle as fuck movie, but it's not.
Oh, sure.
It's not that.
Yeah.
Because turns out Danny Boyle is a chameleon of cinema, and what makes a Danny Boyle movie a Danny Boyle movie isn't how hip and Guy Ritchie it can be at the beginning of a film.
Sure.
And instead...
Which I think is a good thing.
I totally agree. That's right. I'm glad that it's... I mean, normally when you go into... Like this, like I was saying last week, this was the first time I'd seen Trainspotting.
Mm-hmm.
And normally when you go into a movie that is ultimately the career-defining film for an auteur, you watch it and you go, oh, I see all the things. We did Devil's Backbone. See that, right? That's kind of the opposite of Trainspotting. But instead, I watch Trainspotting and I go, oh, okay, so Danny Boyle is given source material and he just makes a great film out of it. That's sort of his style.
Yeah. Well, I also think more than saying defining, I would definitely say launching.
Sure.
I feel like we look at this movie and, you know, that's true, the Del Toro stuff too. But when we see his Reservoir Dogs, we find this place that might have been more personal because it's so much smaller, but it isn't as if we went on to talk about, I mean, Danny Boyle's really... interesting as a case where so much is different between the films.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even the same themes. I mean, we're just in totally different. You could really stretch it and try and talk about, like, I don't know, something, some fucking generic identity and withdrawal and
the only through line I can think of is betrayal of social groups. That's
okay. Yeah, that's a nice one.
It's a heavy one, but it's also specific enough that you can kind of tie it in with a lot of these.
Yeah. You fit it to them because that's a funny thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a... Hey, it turns out Danny Boyle picks the movies that people bring him that he thinks he will do well.
Uh-huh.
Oh, great. That's actually probably how most people do it and then just put their hand a little harder in it. But being able to take a movie and make it look like you're making a hip drug film and then it's almost super.
I know.
It's James Gunn's super. It's mm-hmm. not an easy thing to do.
Because
mm-hmm. you have to accomplish looking fucking cool and you don't want to lucky number 11 that thing up.
Right.
So it has to be cool and at the same time it be ugly.
I mean, it's basically, the movie has to maintain an attitude that it's cool, but not pretentious. See Requiem for a Dream.
Or don't see Requiem for a Dream. That might, after we just made you watch all these films, I don't know if that's a good idea.
But the hipness, the allure of the overt hipness of the film cannot detract from the reality of how awful mm-hmm. everything is for everyone. And the movie, I mean, it's not like the movie's pulling punches. Dead babies, man. If you go dead babies, it's really hard to go, but we're having a good time, right?
I know. I know. You know, the scene where the baby's crawling on the ceiling is mm-hmm. such a good example of this. It is such a stylish, trip out, fun kind of scene.
Sure.
And at the same time, you don't leave the, oh, this is bad. This is a mm-hmm. bad situation we are in. And I think that's probably the height of we're having so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever, because it's a silly scene. Mm-hmm. It's just, and it's not shot as if it's a nightmarish, you will have nightmares about babies crawling on the ceiling type of thing. But it fucks with you thinking about, oh, so he's haunted by the death
right.
of this child and everything that's around him. I mean, so much of this is just, you know that it's, you know, it's bad stuff.
Right.
I'm curious how drug users look at this movie
mm-hmm.
because I can see a place where it
they
looks like
they see this
showing,
as Dazed and Confused.
Where it could be cool culturally because it's
yeah.
a very cool movie. And yet I also think it's super honest in, you know, every, it just fucks everybody's life. It just, much
I mean,
like
yeah,
Vietnam,
it's,
completely
yeah,
destroys
it's,
everything.
It's kind of this thing where out of the gate, it's pretty clear about, you know, when you're addicted to heroin, nobody wins.
Yeah, right.
And I really like doing the long comparison between a movie like this and a movie like Dazed and Confused, which goes, hey, your social group's doing a lot of drugs. That's
yeah.
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, right.
Because the characters here all think they're in Dazed and Confused.
Yeah,
they think that this is one fun summer.
Well, you can see when the colossal drug pimp rises up, mm-hmm. you're just going, you're fucking ridiculous. You think this is so cool, don't you? You are fucking embarrassing. Yeah, the other thing that this movie really talks about more specifically than just the drugs and how people, what it does to people's lives, it has an arc that is specifically or tries to be specifically about telling yourself you're going to change,
mm-hmm.
telling yourself you're going to
absolutely
you're going to quit.
Sure.
We hit on that a little bit with the ending,
mm-hmm.
but you could almost lose that because of how much the characters do.
Right.
So this guy goes, here, let me tell you about how you detox and quit. I'm going to show you how it goes. You go out, you get these supplies, you do this thing.
Shoot
and
a dog.
He sets all this stuff up like it's going to be, you know, the perfect heist
mm-hmm.
that he is, you know, he's totally prepped. And that lasts for all of 5 seconds. I mean, I'm thinking, okay, yeah, the whole movie is going to be trying to get through these withdrawals because we've done so much setup and so much, and you know, just no change.
Right.
And I think there is an argument in that it's very hard chemically, but also, as I've said before on the show, so much of it is your social circle.
Exactly. And
you know, when you come back to a place where somebody goes, hey, but drugs though, you want to do some of those?
Sure.
I mean, sure is exactly,
yeah, sure.
Is exactly your
whatever.
Response. I just bought all this stuff from the grocery store in order to do this withdrawal thing. But if you have some drugs, I mean, we might
yeah.
as well use them, right?
I mean, I'm still addicted at this point.
Yeah.
I don't want to get re-addicted. So we might as well just continue the addiction. The movie kind of runs a hopeless route where, again, it does hip stuff, but every time it does hip stuff, it does horrible stuff immediately following.
Mm.
I think about that scene where he leaves the club to try to pick up that girl. And that's a really hip, fun, romantic kind of the two of them coming together.
Who would have thought?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're just sitting there going, oh man, I bet she's going to be, you know, she seems down to earth. She's the one that's going to, she's his key out of all this. And then the big drop on that, you go, okay, you should go do some heroin about this maybe.
Yeah. The characters have a hard time getting out of this life even when they're pulling other people in. I mean, that's kind of the problem here is when you add other people to the social group, you're adding to the virus. You're
mm-hmm.
adding to the rotten core here. you need to pull yourself out of that and go somewhere else, and not by, you know, betraying all your friends and stealing their money or anything.
Right.
But it's hard because that's not all that's in play.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's play the Llewyn Davis game again. What's going wrong here? Why did the not getting off heroin happen? Like, what failed in that plan?
It's the places you go, or the places you don't go, or the places you can't go.
Mm-hmm.
It's the availability of all the drugs around you. It's probably, honestly, the reality of comfort in being addicted to drugs after you've been addicted to drugs.
Yeah, right.
If it's a feeling you know, it's a feeling you're comfortable with. If you're more comfortable in Vietnam than you are at home, you're just going to go back to Vietnam.
Chasing the high. Yeah. And, you know, the truth is, I think it's a lot of these factors. I don't know that I can point to any one. I mean, I think I always bring up the social circle thing because I think it's almost impossible to do it if you keep the same social circle.
Mm-hmm.
But merely leaving the social circle, as we talked about with the end of the film, does not solve everything.
Right.
You know, you can still get a fix somewhere else. And when you have a down moment, your reaction is probably, oh, what do I do when
sure.
crib death? Oh, I know what I do is I take some heroin, then everything is better.
The movie does kind of the opposite of what The Deer Hunter does, which is exactly what you want this film to do, which is you have no insight into these characters outside of being on heroin. You don't know what it looked like before they got addicted to heroin. You don't know in what order the dominoes fell as far as which of these guys hooked the other ones on drugs.
Right.
You don't know what these guys look like when they're not addicted. So you have the same kind of loss of an answer when you go, so what do, you know, on your average not drug day?
Right.
You don't
right.
know. You can't fathom that idea. You can't even think of these characters, you know, going to work at a fucking Sam Goody.
Yeah.
It was 1999. There's a Sam right. Goody.
Yeah. Yeah. Try and imagine a Scanner Darkly without D.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just, who are these people then? Yeah. I think the movie also, by doing that, it keeps you in hopelessness.
Sure.
Because you wouldn't even if things got good, you wouldn't even know what the fuck that looked like because right. you've never seen it.
Yeah.
It would be totally foreign to you. And both of the movies today are like that. It's just the exception is in the other movie, we see the precursor.
Mm-hmm.
But once it gets bad, we kind of know. I mean, this is life now. We have to accept this. And I think it's really interesting to look at these movies together beyond the theme, but even just at having that point of comparison and not, I still feel like we stay pretty hopeless, even though I have brief moments in Trainspotting where I don't in The Deer Hunter, that mm-hmm. things might get better.
Sure.
That maybe this is the time or maybe this is the time.
And that's because unlike The Deer Hunter, you have these characters that want to be likable and these characters that have an enjoyable social circle. That's probably part of the source of the ongoing damage is that if they were to approach their first trying to get clean the way Robert De Niro looks at Vietnam when he goes back to hunting deer,
mm-hmm.
if they were to look back at it as this horrible, horrible place that they wish they had never gone to in the first place, then you might see one of them, you know, you might see Ewan McGregor going back in to pull another one out who was only going to kill himself, right? Followed the exact same plot as, no spoilers, another movie we've seen on today's show. But instead, when they're not on drugs, and the movie, you know, covers it right at the beginning, when they're clean, they're not sitting there going, oh my God, what was I thinking? They're sitting there like, yeah, I mean, you know, heroin's the other option. You could, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of like, yeah, I'm not in school right now.
Yeah.
It's not just, it, you know, especially people from our generation, not being in school right now is a very temporary phase.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
There's always this lingering reality to people, you're in my age and a little younger, where it goes, I mean, I guess I could go back to school, or I guess I could just start doing heroin again.
I constantly go, I didn't go to MIT. Why didn't I do that? Can I still fix that? Can I just move to, I don't want to live there. Wait, what am I going to do at MIT? I don't want to fucking touch technology. Get away from me. Yeah, I mean, the state of their, I hate to use the word optimism here, But another factor that I think might play into this is that they are on drugs and things are good all the time, even when they're fucking terrible, right? So the characters have a kind of relentless optimism, and that's part of the cool upbeat cut of the film, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something that has a gleeful joy even in its darkest moments in here. And that is, for me, I think the biggest reason that I feel like, oh, things are going to get better. Look, this guy really thinks it's going to work out. It's going to be fine. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have the highs and lows of whatever, we've done six of these shows. I'm going to make this unnecessarily personal. When you don't have the highs and lows of what it's like when things are bad or things are good, if stuff is just always totally fine, it creates this kind of complacency.
Mm-hmm.
It was my biggest fear getting on any kind of psychological drugs.
Sure.
Is going, you know, if something bad is happening to you, but you're just going, what are you talking about? Everything feels fine. There is something about the terrible moments of life that, God, they do a lot of things. I think most of all, propel you to go fucking do something. And these guys, let's say they flipped a switch and they were all clean and not addicted. They have no ambition in life. They wouldn't even know the first hair towards what do I want to do and how do I get there. And I think bad moments can be a real key part of making your life better, of propelling you, of igniting the fire. I mean, some of the worst things that have ever happened in my life have been the moments I go, okay, well, I gotta like fucking make something. I gotta do something here. I gotta switch a situation.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just start taking birth control and not tell my husband. Oh, that's a different double feature. You don't wanna live in that complacent world. And that's, you know, that's where I've had a hard time through these drug movies. They force me to keep thinking about antidepressants and where that weird line is mm-hmm. on, you know, at what point are you just, I don't want to have bad moods, so I'll medicate some more. Because once you start on, I mean, the kind of depression I have is like, you can't be alive anymore with this, which is how I ended up getting on medication.
Mm-hmm.
But then you can adjust it and tweak it so it just gets better and better and better. And then eventually, it's just like everything's the best all the time. And you go, at some point, did this become recreational? Did something happen?
Right.
Well, I don't give a fuck. It's good all the time. So thankfully, the medication doesn't work a lot. That's the only thing. I look at those bleak few moments where a window opens and it's raining outside. And I go, oh, yeah, there's still bad stuff in life. I should probably stop hanging out and just chilling and go like do a thing. And those are important. If those went away completely, I mean, that's the point where it's like, oh, this is definitely making it worse by making it better. Do you look at these characters and see optimism? I mean, can you ever find a moment of them going, even when he wants to kick stuff, it doesn't feel bad?
No. I mean, when Robert Carlyle throws a glass mug onto a woman's head,
yeah,
he does it. He's just like, all right, a good chance to fight about it. I'm just, yeah, and totally. That's one of the, when the scene freezes with the, he's throwing it and it's frozen going over the thing, I'm terrified that whole time.
Yeah, right.
And there's no, the only point in time where you see any doubt as to the necessity or okayness of what's going on is right before Ewan McGregor lifts the money and leaves. It's the only time he's going, fuck this shit.
Yeah, right.
Which is, I guess, a glimmer of hope that he's going to, you know, finally get straight and get his life right. But he's not. He's a drug addict.
Well,
he's going to die.
His fuck this has led him to do something awful. Mm-hmm. I mean, his moment of fuck this definitely was not a motivational moment of clarity. And even if it was, when he has a moment of clarity, his internal moral compass goes, the right thing to do here is steal the money and take off. I mean, he knows that's not true because he then talks about, well, I make all these excuses for mm-hmm. myself. But if you've spent so much of your life on drugs, living and doing bad things, then once you get clean, that doesn't mean you instantly know how to do good things.
Right.
And I think most people, I mean, we have morality without religion. Morality is born in us or taught early. And I think because most people are good, we continue to hold each other up. But it is also instinctive. You instinctively know the right thing to do, and drugs can untrain you from that. Living a life where you, for chemical reasons, just don't care about your moral compass and you just do bad for a decade. Once you get off the drugs, it's not like you instinctively know what good things are. You've spent your whole life doing anything to get a fix.
Right.
The biggest danger of drug outside of the person themselves ODing is how far people go. You see that in the movie, how fucking far people go to get a fix. I mean, they will screw over every friend they have. They will murder. How many fucking murders in this country happen over, you know, when you need that fix, nothing is going to stop you. No amount of humility, no amount of stealing, no amount of not committing fucking murder. It's just, well, I need this. So obviously anything I have to do to get it is okay. I will swim in a toilet or, you know, I was going to say shoot someone's dog, but I don't think that gets many closer to, I don't think like drugs pop out of the, it's not like
it's
two
a video
points.
Game.
you get a coin. Here's your heroin coin. All right. So we've hit one of the last chapters in America and thus double features, involvement in Vietnam and in drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, feel strong. Feel strong.
Okay. What we learned here today is feel strong.
Yeah.
This was good because I felt like we hit a lot of conclusions by
definitely.
Doing this. And maybe that means these are perhaps some of the most realistic movies along the road here.
Yeah.
We have a website. It's doublefeature.fm. You can find the other movies. American Sniper, Man with the Golden Arm, Platoon, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Full Metal Jacket, Head. I don't know, Top Gun and Dazed and Confused.
Uh-huh. Those are some good
and,
picks.
Yeah, all of those are in there. All of those are in there. And you can go listen to them. Next time on Double Feature, we have some producers to thank. I don't know how many times I've said that this year. That is me fucking up the show and then rapidly scrolling around. Like, what are we doing next time on the show, Michael?
Next time on the show, so we've already kind of hit a strong moment in shock 3 weeks ago. We hit a strong moment in depression last week. This week, we've concluded the horrors of Vietnam and drugs. So I figured in the true celebration of all that is Double Feature Year 9, we'll just do a big old episode about racism next week. So we're going to cover Sam Fuller's White Dog.
Racist.
Which is awesome because Samuel Fuller is the second to last Cecil B. Demented director for Double Feature to check off the list.
Yeah, but why does it have to be a white dog?
You'll see. And we're pairing that with Blazing Saddles, which is a Mel Brooks movie that everybody knows is about racism. But I have some very interesting questions to ask you and actually Mel Brooks, but you look the most like him.
I'm the two of us. I will
you're,
be representing
you're
Mel Brooks.
You're resident Mel Brooks on
time.
Double Feature next week.
We can't go. We literally can't go without thinking Seth Hanasek, Liam Duffy, Christopher Peterson, Jeremy Mumenthaler, Athena Banks, Tom Comey, Jill Moriarty, Eric Tachek, and Charles Crawford for this and let's say other great episodes.
Let's watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.
All I wanted to know is if we're going to do, are we going to tell people if patreon.com/double feature?
Yeah.
We're going to tell people.
I mean, yeah, we're going
to. I think we have to
light
tell
the fire.
I think we have to announce
to
people.
This has been a long time coming. We've tried to figure out a good way to go about this. We decided that since we had a floating additional content and then a floating additional year of the show, neither of which we were sure were going to get done in a timely fashion. Decided to do to pull a double bait on this. So we're going to revisit Killapalooza in that we're going to go back through. We're going to do the one where Jason's got to protect his weed. We're going to do the one where Freddy is decidedly shorter than he used to be. We're going to do the one where Angus Scrimm is still alive. Oh, we're going to do the one where the little wrestler is supposedly a leprechaun.
Right. Hold on. Before you give any more of these away, what you're saying for the uninitiated is that we're going to re-up franchises by doing the versions, the sequels we right. didn't talk yeah. about. They're almost all reboots, yeah. actually.
We're going to go back.
I don't want to give away every franchise because, as I just discovered, some of them have 10 fucking sequels in the less than 10 years since
we're basically going to re-up our street cred, because over the last 10 years, apparently Hollywood has decided to make us liars about having said we've covered every Jason movie, or saying we've covered yeah. every Amityville movie, or every Hellraiser movie,
or every Halloween.
So we're going to go through.
Oh, wait.
We're good on Halloween.
thanks, Rob.
But so we're going to go back through. We're going to make liars of history by making The Truth of Tomorrow.
Whoa.
But there are too many movies possibly to do in a single additional content. So also go to patreon.com/double feature so that we can do the other chunk of all these movies for the next AC, next set of additional content. Does this make sense?
This is all. I mean, for $8, you can get all of the old AC and this time next year, get the new AC. But for $10, you can get this stuff as it comes out and contribute to it. So you will get every single episode of Double Feature that's ever been made that isn't available anymore. And also this brand new Return to the Killapalooza uh-huh. that yeah. is exclusive. I guess it's Killapalooza 31 and 32 that are additional yeah. content episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty big thing. We had a blast just looking up all of the movies uh-huh. that have sequels uh-huh. now. That in itself was a great show that we didn't even record.
Yeah.
All right, that's patreon.com/double feature. And, oh, how do we end the show now that we already ended the show?
I mean,
this is awkward.